I'm still only in Saigon.
I have
current geek.
Hello, dear listeners, and welcome back to Current Geek. This is the Current Geek Film Festival, a special monthly look at the greatest movies of all time from a geeky perspective. I'm Scott Johnson. He's Tom Merritt. This week, we are talking about the film Apocalypse Now.
Number 29.
Whoa.
We've done 29 of these now.
That's crazy. That's 29 months. Think of that.
I'm thinking we should do our top 10 of the ones we've seen.
Oh, we could do that.
At some point. I don't know if now's the time, but maybe like when we get 30 or 40 or something.
Yeah, we could do a little listy list.
What is our top 10 of the top movies of all time?
Right, because at some point we're going to have to say whether or not we think these belong on the list or not in whole or in part. And I don't know. I feel pretty good about today's selection, but we'll talk about that in a minute. Apocalypse Now, huge movie, 1979, big splash, made a giant impact, just about killed everybody involved, it sounds like, by some of the trivia.
May 10th, 1979 at the Cannes Film Festival, where it won the Palme d'Or, and then started into limited release August 15th. By October, it was everywhere in the U.S.
Don't you feel like, so this is your second viewing, it's my third. Don't you feel like this, if of all the movies we've watched, there's just zero question this one belongs on the list? Like, it absolutely does.
For me, that is definitely true. I was blown away by how well it has held up.
Yeah.
I probably watched it around 1989, 1990, somewhere along those lines, and remember liking it and thinking like, oh, this is what all the hubbub is about. I get it now.
Yeah.
That's kind of my review at the time as a 19-year-old. But now watching it, I was like, man, this movie, I appreciate it so much more. It looks amazing. Mm-hmm. It doesn't look dated. It doesn't feel out of place. It flows. And I think the thing that's most impressive about Apocalypse Now to me, and again, we watched the theatrical cut.
Right.
So I don't know, maybe you get a different thing if you watch Redux or the final cut. But the theatrical cut for me this time really showed that this movie is neither anti-war or pro-war. Mm-hmm. It is showing war.
Yeah. Yeah. Just a naked look at war. I mean, Redux and Final Cut, which I've seen both of those. I don't remember what order. In fact, those were my first. That was my first exposure to the movie.
As far as I know, Redux is where he put a lot of deleted scenes back in, mm-hmm. and then Final Cut was where he realized, well, that kind of bloated the movie too much. Let me like selectively pick which one of those deleted scenes I'm going to keep and call this my final version.
Yeah, and that of the three. So here's the funny thing that I found. Of the three, they're all good. But having seen them semi-recently, in the last couple of years, I think the Redux is my least favorite because it doesn't feel as well-paced.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably, again, because of that 49 minutes that they put back in. It was incredible when I saw it, so I didn't have anything to compare it to. But then I saw Final Cut, and I went, oh, I like this better. Something about this feels better. Wasn't sure what it was. Now, after seeing the theatrical release, I think it might be my favorite, weirdly. Not just because it's shorter than the others.
Although that's part of it.
It is part of it, maybe, but I think the pacing is so tight in this viewing.
Yeah.
It's so good that
And if I'm right, and I haven't seen Redux or Final Cut, the difference is the French plantation scene, right? Mm. That's and there's other differences too, but that's the big piece that's not there in the theatrical release.
Correct. And that is a long drawn out deal that I can see why they didn't use it. Like, it didn't miss it. Let's put it that way. I did not miss that stuff. It didn't add to anything. It didn't change how I felt about these characters or their.
And there's also slightly different endings, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 And the way this one just flowed felt better to me. I don't know. I really couldn't even give you a good answer as to why it did.
It's interesting for that to be the case, where a lot of times you see the director's cut, say, of, I don't know, Star Trek, the original movie, or
Blade Runner. Blade Runner's good. Yeah, that's
and,
a good
and cut. You're like, oh no, this works a little better. It's too bad they had to make compromises. Whereas with Apocalypse Now, it sounds like you're saying now the way he cut it for the theater really works.
It really did, and I think the big one of the big changes that I thought I would have a problem with here is in the Redux. I think is the one, or possibly Final Cut. Yeah, I don't remember, but they changed music stuff a bit. So it's not as much of that as a synthy 70s stuff going on.
Ah, uh-huh.
And at the time I thought, oh, I like that. That makes us feel more modern and more relevant. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that they removed whatever it was, but I hadn't seen it really, so I couldn't really say. Seeing it now, it's fine. It's fine. It wasn't a big deal. In fact, if anything, it kind of adds a weird tinge to everything that I kind of like. So I don't know. I'm coming away from this liking the theatrical the most. I think it may be a perfect movie. And no matter what you do to it, for good or for bad or for even, it doesn't really matter. Like the source film is so good and holds up so well that, like, there are times where I'm watching this going, was this film last week?
Yeah, what is there? And it just looks good. And it's shot on film.
Yeah.
And we still see things shot on film. So you don't get that weird, like, oh, yeah, this doesn't have the technology, right? It's mm-hmm. widescreen. And if you're watching it at home on a TV, you're even less likely to see the difference, right? Because mm-hmm. you're seeing it, you know, possibly cropped, depending on which version you're looking at.
Sure.
But it was shot to be widescreen. It's not, you're not going to see black bars or anything like that.
Yeah.
And it just looks gorgeous. It was, the cinematography was sensational.
Yeah. Nothing quite like it. It holds up in that way. The sound work is incredible. Mm-hmm. There are a few, you know, overdub moments that all movies do, but some do better than others that you can tell, like when they're walking through the jungle and there's a tiger in there. It's a little bit of stuff where I'm like, I don't think you can tell they're in the studio at the moment for that little bit of dialogue they just exchanged. But for most of the actual, like, war footage, gun sound stuff, this is ahead of its time for the era. The era featured a lot of repeating noises, a lot of stock footage sound.
Yep.
And this didn't have that. It had really intense stuff going on. And this was something, I read a thing about it being one of the first films to use some sort of stereo technology that nobody had used yet or something. I wish I had written that down or found out where I read that, but there's something.
Well, it was a 5.1 surround sound system that was sort of a first of its kind.
Yeah.
You didn't get it in every theater. The 35 millimeter release used Dolby Stereo Optical, but due to the limitations, most of the theaters weren't able to play that. But the 70 millimeter release used two channels of sound from behind the audience, as well as three channels of sound from behind the movie screen. So you had true surround sound here, thanks to the Walter Murch sound work that was done on it. It was quite well done. And even if you're not watching it now with 5.1 surround sound, it's just so well balanced, so well mixed.
Yeah, it's really, really something. And it has this strange, uncanny valley quality to it, because all of these people in it, I know who they are. Like, I know Martin Sheen is in his 70s. And is a squatty little gray man now. I know that Morpheus is not this young 17-year-old kid on the boat now. I know how Harrison Ford looks, certainly, compared to what he looked like in this movie for his brief cameo. Not cameo, but his small part. And knowing all of that, but watching it and it not feeling old to me, the movie doesn't feel old. It feels new. It feels relevant. It feels like somebody made a Vietnam War pick this year and it's up for Oscars kind of feeling.
And it did a great job with the wardrobe and the setting, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so many things here. I mean, first of all, like you say, the fact that they went to the trouble of recording the most up-to-date gunfire, recreated the mood of the jungle, did not settle for stock effects or what they had recorded in the Philippines where they shot it, because it wasn't adequate and really worked on it. That shows the fact that it was done in an actual country close to the climate of Vietnam made it feel real. They weren't out on a set somewhere on a lot trying to recreate it. The fact that they were able to get, and granted, one of the things this time around that took me out of it that would never have before was some of the extras started to look a little like my wife's family, because they're shot in the Philippines. Sure. And I'm like, those aren't Vietnamese people. But it didn't really take me out of it much. And the balance of it was you got these large groups of folks that looked indigenous, because they were from the area they were in. So mm-hmm. even if it wasn't exactly Vietnamese, it was better than having, you know, just a bunch of LA extras, you know, dressed up and put out there. It felt real. And I think the fact that it was also shot in 78, 77 is a good thing, because it was close enough to the time it was from that they could get a lot of the same equipment. They called in a lot of favors with the Philippine government and with the U.S. Army to get period appropriate boats and gear and stuff that they didn't have to recreate. They were using the original stuff, and it wasn't that old. So it didn't stick out. Mm-hmm. And just it looked like an impeccable period piece, which in fact it was.
Yeah, it really was. And it's so good at making me feel like I'm down that river and there's fog hanging low on the river, and it's the hottest, sweatiest place ever. And the further they get into it, the crazier it gets. Not just because the people start losing their minds the closer they get to Kurtz, but the surroundings become more wild and jungly. And by the time you're you know into Cambodia, you're seeing those statues and all that crazy stuff, like ancient stuff around, and it just becomes otherworldly. But not in a way that takes me out of it. It just is this reminder that there are some deep places, there are some deep, dark places in this world that are sort of untouched by us. And they are as much a character in this movie as the people are for me. So when it starts, it's like, okay, well, we're, you know, entering the conflict like we do. And now we're in the conflict and there's some things going on. And then our first push is to clear out this entrance so we can get in there. And we're going to do that with, I can't think of his name. I like the smell of napalm in the morning. What's his name? Can't think of his name.
Oh, Robert Duvall.
Robert Duvall, yeah.
Lieutenant Kilgore.
Yeah, he's fantastic and everything. But anyway, that whole bit is a little crazy, but not exactly crazy yet. You know, he's a little nuts, but still a good leader. His men are doing their job. Everyone's acting like army people. And then they get a little closer, and more people are a little bit nuts. And by the time they get to that bridge where they're just firing off flares and throwing people over the edge and shooting at nothing, and it just starts to become this surreal thing that is genuinely gives me just the creeps. Like that whole descent into that place is, you know, it's a visual descent into what is supposed to be a descent into madness. It's supposed to follow what these characters feel and where they go and what they do. And I really like it. It's just something I've never seen another movie quite get that out of me. And
yeah. Okay. So, it's no surprise that Vittorio Storaro won an Oscar for best cinematography for Apocalypse Now. Walter Murch, along with Mark Berger, Richard Beggs, and Nat Boxer, won an Oscar for best sound. It is a tragedy that this did not get best writing. John Milius and Francis Ford Coppola were nominated for an Academy Award for best writing, but they did not win it that year. Instead, let's see if I could find it real quick, because it was 1979.
Oh, but,
man, I'm scrolling away here. The award went to Kramer versus Kramer, which also won best picture that year.
Yeah,
but John Milius's story here, and yeah, you know, the legend is, and it's not a legend, it's mostly true, is that this is based on Heart of Darkness by mm-hmm. Joseph Conrad. Right. In fact, the famous documentary about the making of Apocalypse Now is called Hearts of Darkness. Yeah. John Milius was encouraged by George Lucas and Steven Spielberg to write a Vietnam War film because Milius had wanted to volunteer for the war and was rejected for having asthma. So he was the one who said, well, what if I adapt Heart of Darkness, but set it in the Vietnam War? He was a huge fan of the novel. His USC professor had challenged his class to write a screenplay for it because no screenwriter had ever perfected a film adaptation of Heart of Darkness. And Coppola gave Milius $15,000 with the promise of an additional $10,000 if the screenplay ever got greenlit. Mm-hmm. So he wrote it in 1969, originally called it The Psychedelic Soldier. And by the time he was done, he said it was no longer an adaptation of Heart of Darkness, but an allegory. In Milius's words, he said it would have been too simple to follow the book completely. I think he just found it more attractive to have the story go in a place that Vietnam would send it versus have it try to stick to the Conrad novel. So you generally get the Conrad story of you've got a guy who's gone on off into the jungle and lost his mind and someone on his way to find him. But otherwise, it departs into its own, as you say, descent into madness. Mm-hmm. And what's brilliant about the way it's told, both direction and screenplay, is the fact that you're at the very beginning, you're introduced to Willard and he's off his rocker. And so you know, okay, this guy's crazy, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But everyone around him is either, you know, solid, stick up their butt, you know, Harrison Ford's character, Colonel Lucas mm-hmm. kind of stuff, or they're laid back, like, don't want to be here, but I'll make do while I can, like Lawrence Fishburne, like Clean. And so what you watch is Willard kind of get his stuff together while everyone else is losing it around him. Mm. And it's almost like they're going in opposite directions. As he gets closer to his objective, he's stronger and more solid because he has a purpose, whereas everyone else just can't deal because... Mm-hmm. As it shows, war is madness.
Yeah, and everyone's losing it bit by bit, some more than others, and some, you know, literally lose their lives before they can completely lose it. But that's just chipping away, and he's kind of just chilling, reading, narrating, you know, getting ready for the confrontation, learning as much as he can about Kurtz. He's basically a government assassin in this case to take him out and finish this job. And he doesn't get his chance to lose it until the very end when he...
Right, because he kind of descends... He ascends out of madness until he arrives at Kurtz, and then he's reinfected. And again, I kind of take that as when he had a mission, he was always fine.
Right, right.
It was when his mission came to an end or was near an end that he lost it.
Which is, a like you said earlier, it's a little slice of war commentary that you don't get to hear very often. It doesn't take a pro stance or a against stance. It's just, hey, this is how it works. And I guarantee there are people who stay driven under that pressure, under that duress, under that kind of intensity because they have a mission. And when they don't have a mission, they don't know what to do. Right? So
wartime is the most extreme version of that.
Yeah.
I would imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's just, it's one of a kind.
And I know there are people listening to this right now saying, I know this is anti-war because I have this anti-war friend who constantly cites this aspect of it. Or I know this is pro-war because Ride of the Valkyries is used by actual military people. And the fact is it's neither because both are true.
Yeah.
Because everyone can point at something and say, I want to make my point about war and use this part of Apocalypse Now as the example, pro, con, or otherwise. It really is a very difficult thing for a movie to achieve, reflecting more of a totality about a subject than taking a stance, taking a perspective on it, which is incredible.
Completely agree. And it's easy to say, well, it's obviously anti-war because everything's really dark and depressing and, you know, difficult and whatever. I just think that's matter of factness about the nature of war. Like you can't pretend that it's a party. So
because you can also say that, but Lieutenant Kilgore is glorifying war.
Yeah.
And totally showing could. That, you know, yeah, the brave soldier who rises above never gets harmed.
Yeah.
That's also, I'm a real character. I mean, that is basically a general MacArthur, General MacArthur. That's all the legends about him, or that he would just, you know, walk out in a field riddled with bullets and never get hit.
Yeah. Wasn't afraid of it. Didn't even flinch.
Yeah. And honestly, you know, it's a little bit of a selection bias. We hear about the people who do that because they didn't get hit. Yeah. Anyone who got hit is just like, oh, well, that person died in action.
Yeah. No, you're right. You never do hear about them. You know, the ones that, it's exactly, it's like saying my grandpa smoked cigars every day and he lived to be 99.
Right.
Well, yeah, because he lived to be 99 is why you're saying
no one's impressed by the story of my grandpa smoked cigars every day and died of lung cancer.
Yeah. Like at age 38, like they don't do that because.
Or even age 65, right? It doesn't matter. It's like, you know.
Yeah. I don't know. There's something to be learned there, but it's, it is really. Oh, man. It's the kind of movie that would have scarred me as a kid. I'm kind of glad I didn't see it when I was too young. I guess I would have been 9 or 10 when it was made. What's weird is you were saying you saw it in 89 for the first time. It's weird to think that was only 10 years after it was made.
Right.
Whereas if I said, hey, when's the last time you saw or when the first time you saw The Matrix, you'd say, oh, it feels like yesterday. But that was 20 years ago. 21 yeah. almost 21 years ago. So that gives you some perspective on how things change as you get older. But anyway.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. It would be like if I saw The Matrix for the first time in 2009 mm-hmm. and then in 2049 saw it again.
Yeah. Yeah. And how weird is that? Like, that's just a weird juxtaposition of time. But what I was going to say was, when I was a kid, if I saw, even in high school, when I saw like a Full Metal Jacket, that thing just left me in tatters. It messed me up. Like, war movies, especially Vietnam War movies, really got under my skin. And so I think I may have even avoided this movie for a while because of those reasons. And I think it would have been just too hard for me when I was younger. Just didn't have the right sensibilities for it. But man, do I appreciate it now for what it is. It's just a heck of a thing. And I don't know that, you know, a lot of people say, well, that's the movie that really broke the director, that he couldn't do anything after that. You just didn't see much good stuff come from him since then, a thing here or there. But really, that was Coppola's final moment, and it just tore him to pieces.
If it wasn't for this, Godfather 3 would have been good.
Right. I've heard that before. I've heard people say that. Yeah. And I think what made Godfather 3 bad was, I hate to say it, but it was him hiring his daughter. She was terrible in it. But the rest of the movies, it's all right. It's not the worst thing ever. It's a very 80s take, but it's fine. But the I don't want to say that this movie's the reason. And I haven't seen the documentary, so maybe they go into this. But his work post Apocalypse Now is not, you know, it's nothing. He never returned to the height. It never got that good again.
Well, I mean, sure. He also only did one movie. Well, not even a movie. He hadn't done a movie after Godfather Part II until
right?
Apocalypse Now. Now, granted, he was working on Apocalypse Now for several years in there, but he didn't want to do it. Originally, George Lucas was going to direct it in like 1971.
Mm-hmm.
And Lucas was going to shoot it in South Vietnam.
Oh, man.
While the war was still going on. Wow. This tells you a lot about the mindset at the time. Like, right now we're like, well, that's ridiculous. You're about to lose the war. But they didn't know that.
Yeah.
They thought South Vietnam was going to be like South Korea. And so you'd be like, oh, yeah, the war would still be going on up north, mm-hmm. but we'll shoot in South Vietnam and be able to use actual soldiers, actual equipment, and tell the story while the... Can you imagine if that had been the case?
Oh, man.
If they had pulled that off?
Yeah, that would have been something else.
That's an insane thought.
Right.
It didn't happen, obviously. They couldn't get approval for it. Also, mostly the studios didn't want to risk it. They're like, it's an active war zone. I don't think we want to carry that insurance.
Sure.
And Lucas was doing American Graffiti. They didn't want to distract him from that. And then eventually he got Star Wars going. And once Star Wars was going, he said, you know what? I just can't do Apocalypse Now, and handed it back to Coppola.
Which is crazy to think that George Lucas was almost the director of.
Like, he was working on it. It wasn't like a maybe I'll do it. He was actively working on it.
Yeah, that just blows my mind because I don't know what that is. Is it tonally different? Is it? Maybe it's better. Maybe it's as good. Maybe it's worse. I don't know. I don't know what I would think of that. I almost need to jump to whatever timeline happened where that happened. He made it. Someone else did Star Wars, or it never happened. And he made Apocalypse Now. What does that movie look like with George Lucas at the helm?
Yeah,
I would love to know. But yeah, I did not know that going into this. And I was doing deep dive yesterday, and I was like, oh my gosh, really?
Lucas worked with Milius for 4 years developing the film.
Jeez.
Intended to shoot it after making THX-1138, but they couldn't get the location. And then he got involved with American Graffiti and then Star Wars. And so he eventually just had to hand it off.
See, now American Graffiti leads me to think that maybe he had the chops for it, because that movie is very, very different tonally from anything else Lucas has ever done. And he really never did anything like that since. I mean, THX was sort of like that, I guess.
Well, and this is where I want to bring a big loop back to your thing about Coppola.
Yeah.
Star Wars also broke George Lucas by that logic.
Yeah. I mean, right? I don't disagree.
I mean, it's not necessarily Apocalypse Now that did it so much as you reach a point in your career where you can either keep going or you just kind of pull back on the accelerator. And some folks like Ridley Scott, just kind of keep going, you know, towards the end of their life, pull back a little bit now, becoming more of a producer, but he kept making movies. Who am I thinking of?
Too? Oh, well, Spielberg's a good example of someone who pushed through that.
Keeps going. Like he keeps the rhythm going.
Like,
yeah.
Like didn't matter what levels of success he would hit. He would somehow figure out a way to move
but
past
people
it.
People also forget like Cotton Club was a good movie.
Yeah, it was a good movie.
Sue Got Married was a fun movie.
Yeah, it was
Tucker
a good time. Sure.
Was not, you know, may have been a failure at the box office, but wasn't a bad movie.
I liked Tucker. I'll go on the record right now to say I liked Tucker, A Man in His Dream. Yeah. Or is it a car in his dream? Or I don't remember.
Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Yeah, the guy started getting a little weird.
You know, he's not that great. Then you have The Rainmaker. I mean, it's not that Coppola stopped making good movies. It's more that Apocalypse Now was so good, and he made The Godfathers Part 1 and 2.
Right.
That people are like, well, why didn't he just keep making the greatest movies of all time? And it's, to me, that's kind of unfair. It's
it
like,
is
well,
a little unfair, sure.
You know, maybe you should have spaced them out more, but how many people can say they made three of the greatest movies of all time at all?
It's a rarefied space. Ironically, it's a lot of the same guys who were at school at the same time. It's Spielberg and Scorsese are probably the best examples of guys in that group who went on to just keep topping themselves. Or at least equaling themselves. I mean, you could argue that they're...
Also, what did he do before The Godfather, folks?
Yeah.
Was he broken before that and then suddenly fixed himself? Because honestly, The Cotton Club, Peggy Sue Got Married, and Dracula, those are more well-known than The Rain People and You're a Big Boy Now, which are two of the movies he made before The Godfather.
Yeah. They're better than...
I don't know. I don't know if I believe that it broke him.
Yeah.
He poured his all into it and never felt like he could best himself.
Or needed to.
There's a little psychological thing that could happen.
Yeah, he may not have felt like he even needed to. Like, there's a reason
in
that
other
George
words,
Lucas...
The motivation, like, once you've achieved your greatness, you don't go out and you're not as motivated to be like, and now I must do it again. Instead, you make Peggy Sue Got Married. You're like, this will be fun.
Yeah, and the public constantly demands that, and I don't know why we do that. It's not fair necessarily. Spielberg's a weird egg. He just was going to keep going no matter what. Scorsese, same thing. But you could say, like, Brian De Palma was in that crew, and I think he peaked out at, like, The Untouchables, I would say, in 86. And I don't think he was ever any good after that. But again, maybe it's because De Palma was like, "Yeah, I'm good. I've made maybe my best movie. I'm gonna not do."
Or look at Stanley Kubrick, right?
Sure, he's another good example. Yeah,
he can't. He's dead. But
I can look at his gravestone.
He just kept making good to great movies constantly throughout his career.
Yeah,
but he never made The Godfather.
Right.
Right. You could say like, oh, but he made 2001 and he made this and he made that and he made great movies, but none of them ever got the universal praise of The Godfather or Apocalypse Now.
Right.
And I think that's a big part of it, because then he's still motivated like, nobody appreciated Clockwork Orange. Well, OK, I'm going to keep going. I'm going to keep making something else. I don't know.
Yeah. Hard to say. Like, I wish, and there's part of me would like to see what a Stanley Kubrick is up to these days. Had he not passed? Mm-hmm. I mean, it was probably time, but you know, if he had another 20 years in him, like what does he do in the aughts and in the 2010s? What does that guy produce, make, collaborate on? Like, what is his impact? And the thing is, you know, Coppola's still around and we could still sort of ask that of him, but I think he's probably done. Probably doesn't want to do this stuff anymore.
He's still making movies.
Is he? What's he doing these
days?
Yeah,
he's he produces a lot, and that happens to a lot of directors. They become producers. He was a producer on a lot of movies, most recently in 2013, but he's a producer on Megalopolis, which isn't out yet. But yeah, he directed, am I looking at the right? Yeah. He directed, he's directing Megalopolis. So I don't know, maybe that'll be great. But he last directed Distant Vision in 2016.
Interesting.
That's the other thing that happens. This happened to Lucas, is once you reach a certain amount of financial success too, you no longer feel like you have to please anybody.
Yeah, you can do what you want to do. And if
you
what
just
you
make
wanna,
stuff that you like,
yeah,
that everyone else may not.
Yeah, and if you're Scorsese, you're like, I still got a few gangster movies in me. And so you do that. And if
or I think it's Scorsese. It's as much like, I like making gangster movies. And luckily enough, a lot of people like watching gangster movies.
Right.
My interests and the public interest kind of coincide.
Yeah. He basically adopted Leonardo DiCaprio as his own son and just makes movies with him. And that's great. Like, you know what? I think you got the right call on this. It's just different strokes, different guys. They had their stroke of genius has happened for that whole crew. And that fascinates me, just that whole film class of that group. Mm-hmm. And they all hung out and they played pool together and they were in class together and they know each other. They're all friends still like that. And this probably already exists somewhere and I just need to find it. But I would love just a big, huge documentary about that crew and that time and what they bounced off of each other. You get a little bit with the Spielberg documentary on HBO, and there's a few other things hanging around. That Brian De Palma documentary has some stuff in it, but I just love that whole thing. It just feels like Francis Ford Coppola, of all of them, came in the strongest in terms of, like, you know, just masterful artistic impact, and then maybe faded off faster than any of them. And again, maybe by his own volition, his own choice, his own whatever, or like you were saying, or maybe he's just, I don't know, he's just tired. I don't know what it is, but it feels like from that movie on, the world was no longer worthy of Francis Ford Coppola's best work. I don't know. That's one way to put it.
Let's talk a little bit about the casting too. Steve McQueen was the first choice to play Willard.
Oh, wow. That would have been all right. I could see that.
Yeah. You were going to get Gene Hackman.
Oh.
To play the Dennis Hopper role.
Okay. I could see that. Nervous and loud and obnoxious.
Wanted to go to the Philippines for that role. Right. Although Hackman, I guess, wouldn't have had to go for very long. But Steve McQueen was like, yeah, I don't know, 5 months in the jungle in a remote location in the Philippines. Maybe my friend Al Pacino would be interested. So he was also offered the role, but he also was afraid of falling ill in the jungle because he had done just that when they were shooting in the Dominican Republic for The Godfather Part II.
Right.
Jack Nicholson, Robert Redford, James Caan were all approached to play either Kurtz or Willard. Tommy Lee Jones, Keith Carradine, Nick Nolte, and Frederick Forrest, who ended up actually playing Chef, all approached about playing Willard before Martin Sheen.
Yeah.
However, they finally cast and began shooting with Harvey Keitel.
What?
Yeah.
Shut up. Does this exist anywhere? Can I see it?
Because Martin Sheen had screen tested for The Godfather for Michael, and they liked him. So they offered it to Martin Sheen, but he was like, oh, I'm not available. So they gave it to Harvey Keitel. They started principal photography. 3 weeks later, Coppola was like, he's too passive.
Yeah. Oh, and, I'll be dang.
You can see that. Like, Keitel's very aggressive in a way, but he has a very passive nature to him. And they're like, that doesn't work for Willard. Mm-hmm. So they let him go and replaced him with Sheen.
That's crazy. I just found an image too. So I'll put this in our chat here, but there's a set shot of him hanging out with Robert Duvall doing his Robert Duvall business. That surprises me. Didn't know that was the case. I mean, honestly, I can't picture it with anybody but Martin Sheen at this point. This is obviously a star-making turn for him.
Oh, yeah.
And he's very good in it. And he also...
President Bartlett was a vet.
He was, totally was. Yeah, did his service. Yeah, be president later. Kind of the typical path. But he's so good and stony and also kind of handsome and rugged, but in a wiry, weird way. And he looks like his two boys combined. He looks like Emilio Estevez and Charlie Sheen mushed together at this age. So he looks just like a young version of both those guys. And so you get a little Uncanny Valley. Because again, it doesn't feel like a movie in the 70s. It feels like a movie that was just made. And I'm like, how did they get Martin Sheen? Like, what computer magic made Martin Sheen look like he's 19?
How'd they de-age him? Yeah.
Right? Like, that's just nuts to me. But he blows my mind in this role. I think he's extremely perfect for it. And it was the right call. However they got there. This Keitel thing is news to me, though. I had no idea he was in this.
That's they started shooting that in March 1st, 1976. And they had to stop down and then finally convinced Marlon Brando to join in September of 76. So they stopped down after 3 weeks, brought Sheen in, and then were able to get to get Brando. Brando was always who they wanted for Kurtz. Mm-hmm. They had some other options for Kurtz, but mm-hmm. Brando was who they wanted from the beginning. So they were able to get him. There's some stories about him being a little overweight, though, which is one of the reasons you see him shot from the neck up a lot.
Yeah.
And in darkness.
Sure. It works, though. Those shadows and things make him really cool and mysterious. I think that stuff works. But I did one.
James Caan was supposed to play Colonel Lucas.
Oh, wow.
Caan wanted too much money, so they gave it to Harrison Ford, which is one of the weirdest Harrison Ford parts I'll ever see.
Yeah, that is weird. I mean, he looks a little too young for that part, in my opinion.
A little bit, yeah. And
that's a weird thing to say about Harrison Ford as we know him today, but he looks like a 10-year-old.
And that's the other thing. The casting ended up being, like, just terrific.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Marlon Brando, Martin Sheen. Marlon Brando was known then. Martin Sheen wasn't.
Right.
Robert Duvall was known then. Lawrence Fishburne wasn't.
Right.
Pops from Blackish or Morpheus, as you may know him.
Right.
barely looks like himself.
It's
at that
so
age.
Weird. So he really much. Looks yeah. like the 17-year-old kid they're trying to portray, and it's only once in a while you get a glimpse of an expression. You go, it's Morpheus. So you think that's air you're breathing? Or, you know, you expect him to talk like Morpheus. But, yeah, that's a great role. The dude that just slowly loses it, the surfer.
Lance. Yeah.
He's great.
He is played by Sam Bottoms.
That gives me I've never even heard of that dude since or before, but that guy gives me the willies.
He was actually a name already. He'd been in The Last Picture Show and The Outlaw Josie Wade.
Seabiscuit
as well.
Oh, really? Yeah. He genuinely freaks me out. More than anybody in this, maybe more than anyone, because he's just, I can see it. I can see this descent. I can see the breaking of this kid.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because he goes the farthest, right?
Yeah.
Clean was going pretty far, but then he gets killed.
Right.
Lance goes from, you know, superstar surfer, all-American boy to flat-out crazy.
Yeah.
He gets to go all the way to the end.
Yeah, he basically makes it. There's a cut scene, I guess, where Dennis Hopper's character dies, and they didn't include it in any of the cuts. Mm-hmm. I don't know why that was, but, man, I was looking forward to Dennis Hopper getting his, because what a freak nut he is in this thing, too. He's nuts.
Frederick Forrest, who plays Chef. I know you're a fan of Lonesome Dove. He was Blue Duck.
Oh, there you go. Playing with doing Robert Duvall business again. That's cool.
Yeah.
I like that.
And he had also been in The Conversation, Coppola's Gene Hackman.
Do you think there's anything to the idea that Robert Duvall and even Harrison Ford were considered for these roles because of the work they had just done with Lucas on...
Robert Duvall did work with Lucas?
Robert Duvall was in THX, so he was in that weird sci-fi thing.
Yeah. No, I'm sure he was known to them from that. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Harrison certainly was.
Yeah.
So Harrison had been in American Graffiti and Star Wars.
Yeah, yeah. So I wondered if that... Oh, yeah, this is post-Star Wars, isn't it?
Yep.
Weird.
I mean, it started shooting before Star Wars.
Yeah.
76, but it came out after.
That's so weird to me. All right.
So that's why Harrison took a smaller part, because Star Wars, when he signed on the dotted line, he didn't know how big Star Wars was going to be.
Well, let's all be honest. We all thought, like Obi-Wan did, that series was going to be a schlocky, terrible.
It was going to be B-movie stuff. Yeah.
It was going to be bad. Nobody knew.
Cult hit, maybe.
Nobody had any idea. The secret sauce.
Here's the other one. You watched Daredevil, right?
I did, yeah.
Remember Styx?
Oh, yeah.
He was Lieutenant Colby.
Oh, really?
We don't even get a line out of him.
Oh, right. They show him. It's Scott Glenn.
He's the guy
Glenn,
supposedly
then.
They sent to kill Kurtz, who decided to stay on.
Yeah, it sent his letter, that letter to his family saying, "Sell everything, sell the kids."
Yeah, and, you see Willard show up and say, "Colby," and he just kind of stares at him.
Oh, right. I totally forgot. Okay, yeah, that's Scott Glenn, one of my favorite actors ever.
Yeah, he's so good.
I forgot. Because when they show the photo, I went, oh, that looks like Scott Glenn. And then I forgot to think about it again. So now that you've said it, I gotta go dig that up. But man, these guys are young. It's an amazing cast, and they're all great, and nobody sucks. Like, nobody. Nothing's a wasted role.
No.
Captain of the boat is really great. Man, I feel for that guy.
What's his name? Chief Phillips, Albert Hall.
We never learned what happened to the puppy, which bums me out. Right.
Albert Hall ended up in National Treasure Book of Regrets.
Ooh, Book of Regrets. It's not called Book of Regrets, is it? It should be.
What is it called?
They're making a new one, by the way.
Book of Secrets. Sorry. Yeah,
there's a new one, the third one or fourth, whatever it is, that just got announced, which is concerning. But anyway, well, that's cool. Yeah, they all had great careers, all these guys. They all did good.
The other thing that we always like to talk about in these movies is how we sort of get reminded of the quotes, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. The famous quotes. And obviously, "Love the smell of napalm in the morning, smells like victory," is a famous quote you know is coming if you watch Apocalypse Now. What I had forgotten is that that is not the entirety of the quote.
Oh.
It's, "I love the smell of napalm in the morning. You know, one time we had a hill bombed for 12 hours." He starts telling a story in the middle of the quote.
Yep. Yep. He keeps going.
And he says the smell, you know, that gasoline smell, the whole hill smelled like victory.
Victory.
No one quotes that whole thing. It's way too long. They just go, "I love the smell of napalm in the morning." And then they leave out everything else and go, smells like victory, which actually isn't the quote. He said smelled like.
Smelled like victory. Yeah. And it's a great. I love how that ends or that transitions, because after all of that, this frenetic, weird, he wants to surf, but he also wants to take the beach, but he also wants to kill these people, but he also wants to, you know, give his water to one guy or whatever. Like all of that stuff juxtaposed. It's like the most energetic part of the movie, that middle bit. And then he says it smelled like victory and walks away and everything's quiet. And you realize, oh, none of this is fun. Like all of this is bad. This is him just trying. This is his way in his leadership position. His way of sloughing off the parts of war that he doesn't like. It's great.
Everybody has a way. They talk about it. Everybody has a way to deal with whatever they have.
Yeah, that's
for good or ill.
That's a fun.
Also,
thing.
Terminate with extreme prejudice. I'd forgotten that came from Apocalypse Now.
Oh wow, yeah. Oh,
that is I understand what it means. I always thought it was like, what is extreme prejudice? You just terminate somebody. Why do you need extreme prejudice? In the context, they're not saying kill him mm-hmm. outright. They're saying terminate the colonel's command.
Right.
Right? End his command. They're saying, and you know, the way to end his command is to kill him.
Yeah, but here's one way to do it.
They're saying terminate the colonel's command. And Willard says, terminate the colonel. And then the civilian, the CIA guy, says, terminate with extreme prejudice. Mm. In other words, wink, wink.
Yeah.
You know, your extreme prejudice in this case means don't take any excuses for him not giving up his command. If he won't give it up, kill him.
Yeah, it's.
And I was like, oh, I finally understand what that line means.
Right?
Why is it extreme prejudice? Because people use it as kill him, terminate with extreme prejudice. Like, what, kill him more? Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. But now I get it. It's terminate his command, and the extreme prejudice is the killing.
Yeah, no, it's great. I love that when we find the quotes that are a little bit jacked up. We hear them in our head so often that it's basically proved. This experience with you, 29 movies now, is proven to me that the Mandela effect might be bullcrap. Do you know what I'm saying? The sense is real, but there's no. I've already experienced the Mandela effect in like 8 of the movies we've done.
Yeah.
And I went, I didn't know he said it like that. And it's, of course, it's always been that way. So I feel like just having this direct experience with Mandela effect, like quote usage, has made me a better person. Weirdly.
I also totally forgot Charlie Don't Surf.
Oh, that's awesome.
People used to say that a lot. Yeah. I don't think people say that.
I don't know. I mean, if they do now, I don't know anyone who does or why.
Then there's the horror.
Yeah, the horror.
I think people forget that comes from Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
And what was the other one I wanted to say? Someday this war is going to end. I definitely have heard people say that. And just I kind of forgot it was from Apocalypse Now. Thought it was like, you know, just kind of a generic quote of like, meaning like someday all this trouble is going to end, but it's a direct quote.
Yeah. It's right out of this movie.
Colonel Kilgore says it.
I wonder, I mean, okay. So it feels like a movie's memorability. Yeah. Comes from whether or not it has these kinds of lines that just stick out and you always remember them. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's something to that? Like, is it the movie that's good enough so that the lines stick out, or is it the lines stick out and make it a better movie?
I think it's an interplay. A great line can last on its own with no one remembering what movie it came for. It doesn't matter what the movie was. And so that movie doesn't have to be great. It just has to be seen widely enough. It has to be good enough that a lot of people see it, so they start quoting it to each other, right? There's a minimum there. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't have to be one of the greatest movies of all time. Stop trying to make Fetch happen.
Right. Right.
But then there's also a quote that in a lesser movie might not catch people's attention, but because the movie's so good, people want to replay it in their mind more and talk to each other about it. And that feeds certain quotes into working their way into the public discourse. So it's a little of both. Depends on the line, depends on the movie.
Yeah, it's just an interesting little side effect, and I love that they keep coming up on these things. And we're not done. We got so many movies ahead of us that'll probably have a billion quotes like that. It's just the beginning. But anyway,
yeah,
it's very, very good. I think people should just rush out and watch it and get it however you can get it. I was mentioning to Tom, I saw it on IMDb's little free service. It had ads in it, which is, you know.
So what, there are about 5 ad breaks?
Yeah, and it wasn't bad. It was like, well, the only thing that was bad is it was like Hershey's, or it was a lot of, Reese's. It was Reese's peanut butter cups a lot, and I miss those, and I don't eat sugar anymore. So that was a bummer. But
well,
it was
also a little bit of a tone change.
Yes, it definitely was. But it was a really good cut, like a really good transfer. It looked really good, and I assume is as good as any other version that's from the theatrical. But even if you can't access that and you'd rather get one of these longer ones or the ones you think the director would call his final cut, those are amazing too. In fact, I'd straight up watch all three just so you can experience them all. I want to see this documentary. I can never find it anywhere. Hearts of Darkness is like nowhere streaming. So I just got to find it. That's supposed to be amazing. But yeah, like just get out there and see it if you haven't, because it is something else, man. Like war movies and I have a mixed relationship. There's some I think that are incredible, and then there's some, I don't know why everyone likes them or whatever. This is easily in my, if it's not my top, it's in my top 3 war movies ever made.
Well, and I feel like this is in one of, when we were talking about making our top 10, I think this makes my top 10 for sure. Yeah. This is one of my favorites that we've watched so far.
Easily is me, for me as well. And it's up there too. It's like up on that list.
Yeah.
In fact, I'd actually have to go look at the list again to temper where I put it, because right now it's pretty high. And I'm sure I'm going
to
go look at the list.
Yeah, I'd have to do some thinking, because there's you know, they are the greatest movies of all time. But this is the one of the first ones, and we're getting a little farther down the list, of course, but this is one of the first ones where I feel like it should have been higher.
Yeah, and I also think it should have won that year. And it's
Kramer versus Kramer is not that high on our list.
No, of course not.
It's
like,
on there, actually.
But yeah, I'm sure Forrest Gump is too, but guess what's probably higher? I'll bet you Pulp Fiction or Shawshank Redemption are higher on that list too, but they didn't win that year.
Oh, wait, Kramer versus Kramer is not on our list. I take that back.
Oh, well, see, this is my whole point. Like, the Oscars don't necessarily...
Pulp Fiction is number 41 on our list.
Yeah. How can you tell me if Shawshank's on there? It's got to be.
Forrest Gump is number 32 on our list. Yeah. So they're very close.
That's fine.
Shawshank is number 57.
All right. Well, those should be flipped. And I like both. Don't get me wrong. I like Forrest Gump. Not a movie I don't like, but Shawshank was robbed that year. And then Pulp Fiction people would say they were robbed that year. But 94, contentious year for Best Picture. We'll just put it that way. Our next movie for next month is The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly.
Oh, you say you have a mixed history with war films. How do you feel about Westerns?
I love Westerns. I don't love spaghetti Westerns always, but I do like The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly a lot.
I've seen this multiple times.
I have too, and I love it.
I'm excited to have another reason to watch
it. You know what? The spaghetti Western thing grew on me over time. I did not like it at first, because when I was younger, I liked a more traditional sort of, Silverado sort of take on Westerns. It's hard to explain the difference, but... The spaghetti Westerns, which were, you know, Italian directors making these takes on Western lore.
Casting spaghetti in the main role.
It was just a little discordant to me. But then I don't know, I've gained an appreciation more lately. Like, if, you know, quite honestly, something like Django is straight up a spaghetti Western in a lot of ways. It uses a lot of inspiration from those movies. And I really like that movie. I think Hateful Eight, again, another Tarantino movie, but Hateful Eight is a similar kind of experience. And I like them more now than I ever have, and that one's always stood out. The Good, Bad, the Ugly is amazing. So 1966's Best Western, not the place you go stay for a night.
the genre. Yeah, and you can watch it on Stars as of this recording today,
all right.
January 23rd. Depending on when you hear this and when you decide to go look for it, it may or may not still be on Stars. It's also available for rental or purchase, though.
I wonder if... Oh, yeah, there it is. Rent and purchase anywhere. So, looks like everyone's got you covered. All right.
shouldn't be hard to get a hold of if you're willing to pay. If you already have Stars, you can watch it as part of your subscription.
Well, I'm legitimately excited, as everyone else should be. That's next month, the month of February, we're watching that movie, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Don't leave too quick tonight, though, because right after this, Legal Geek covers how theater owners are trying to fight to maintain 70-year-old antitrust consent decrees currently enforced against the major film studios. You've talked a bit about this on DTNS as well.
Yeah, we have.
And how the streaming distribution landscape changes this legal battle. So stick around for that. Always fascinating stuff from Legal Geek. We appreciate it every time he sends us something. Tom, we should probably tell the fine folks anything cool you have going on right now. Got anything?
Oh, my. Yes. Speaking of Daily Tech News Show, that is your 30-minute-a-day capsule of all the things you need to know to understand the world of technology, from 3D printers used to give voice to a 3,000-year-old dead Egyptian priest, to Google's new search changes. It's all there. Stay up to date. Be the smartest person in the room. Subscribe at dailytechnewsshow.com.
Nice. Also, I'd recommend that if you like Current Geek and you like what we're doing with these episodes, let us know. Send us your feedback, currentgeek@gmail.com. And if you really like it, head on over to patreon.com/currentgeek. If you want to get some unique artwork in the mail that you can't get any other way, that's the only way to do it. And there's other levels as well. You could get in for as low as a buck if you want. patreon.com/currentgeek. And a big shout out and thanks to everybody who supports us over there already.
Yeah.
We muchly appreciate it. That's going to do it for us. Don't forget the website, currentgeek.com, @currentgeek. I'm also putting audio up on Library now because they let you do that, not just video, which is kind of cool. So you guys can check that out if you're looking for a different backup or a different version of it, if podcasting just isn't your thing. And also, what else? Our Twitter accounts, Current Geek. Ace Detect is for Tom. You can find me at Scott Johnson. That's going to do it for us, for me, for Tom, for all of you. We'll see you next time.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week, we review how theater owner trade groups are trying to stop the Department of Justice from removing rules that have governed conduct of the major film studios they deal with for over 70 years. Back in the 1930s and 40s, various antitrust enforcement actions by the U.S. government against major film studios led to what is known as the Paramount Consent Decrees. These decrees bar several major studios from owning both the distribution and exhibition operations for films, while also banning a number of specific distribution practices, such as setting a minimum prices for movie tickets, and forcing theaters to license multiple films bundled together instead of individual films. The decrees were intended to separate theater providers from film studios, while also making the film studios play fair in distribution of films to theaters for viewer consumption. These decrees have been active since 1949, and are one of over 1,300 antitrust judgments with no expiration date. Periodically, the Department of Justice reviews these active judgments on the books to determine if all are still necessary, the most recent such review happening in late 2018. That review resulted in the Paramount Consent Decrees being identified as one judgment that the DOJ no longer considered necessary. As such, the DOJ made a court action to terminate these decrees with a 2-year sunset period on some of the current rules. Which brings us to the present, and the counter motions and briefs filed by the theater owner trade groups. The trade groups argue that these provisions have maintained a thriving film exhibition and distribution market, where independent smaller studios can properly compete for screen time, even in towns and regions with fewer screens per theater. The trade groups specifically call out the block booking rule as crucial, noting that bigger studios could force out competitors and smaller studios by demanding a group of their films be licensed simultaneously by a theater in order to have access to the big money-making blockbuster. The trade groups also argue that the government hasn't followed the technical standard for removing such consent decrees from the books, which requires a showing that it's in the public interest to remove such decrees. I expect the DOJ will craft a response arguing that removing this decree is in the public interest to try and overcome this technical legal challenge. Of course, the trade groups do not directly address the government's position regarding the change in the movie industry, with streaming services and the like as alternatives. This sets up to be the potential core of the court decision, as the theater owners have a legitimate concern about potentially being bullied by major film studios, but they may not really be how small independent studios distribute anymore in the age of streaming services. It's a close call, in my legal opinion, and the shifting movie consumption landscape makes this a ripe question for handling in the courts in 2020. The bottom line is, antitrust law and consent decrees have an important place in our regulatory scheme to protect against monopolies and unfair business practices. However, times change in industry, and when change occurs, the same protections from the past may not be applicable. It will be fascinating to see if the courts think that the movie distribution industry has changed enough to take the reins of control off of the major film studios. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.